A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This week on the New Statesman podcast, we have, with me, Stephen Bush, and my colleague, Helen Lewis, never-ending reshuffles, Tory splits over Europe, and Stephanie Boland joins us for the thorny question of whether or not men and women's voices are treated different in serious literature. And we have George Eaton down the line from Westminster with what's going on and what's moving in the House of Commons.
Hi, I'm Helen.
And I'm Stephen.
And this is the New Statesman podcast. Welcome to our relaunch, reshuffled, if you will, Stephen, podcast, which we're trying something slightly different for this week. As you'll notice, I have been much... You are very much the Ken Livingstone of this podcast, actually. You've been appointed to co-chair the podcast review. And we will also be bringing George later in with a segment we might call Down the Line from the Lobby, or we might call a pun on George's name, but he doesn't have much input into that, but let's see. But the good news is that there will be 50 to 60% more Stephen Bush in this podcast than before. So let's start off talking about the reshuffle, because we have to, Stephen. Was it a good reshuffle? I can't believe I'm even asking that question.
I mean, I think the problem is it, at the moment, it's still not entirely clear if one can say it is a finished reshuffle. So the weird thing is it went on for a very long time, and the reason why is indeed at time of recording still technically going on. At first, the reason why it went on is that effectively you always have this problem when you're forming a cabinet or a shadow cabinet. It's slightly easier in opposition because you don't have a majority to protect. In government, of course, if someone resigned and starts voting against you and you have a majority of 12, like Cameron, then suddenly you only have a majority of 10, because obviously they count twice.
That doesn't happen, though, because you're assuming... Well, actually, I was going to say, all of these calculations are thrown out completely by the fact that who knows how many Labour MPs are going to vote in line with Labour Party policy on any given day of the week at the moment.
I mean, so it's more... But it's easier in opposition because you don't have a majority to lose. And if you win an election next time, then everyone will hope they can be in government. So they'll come back around even if they were sacked in the years before the election.
Okay, so let's do the reshuffle roundup for people who've been living under a rock or not following your live blog for the last, what is it now, 30?
We're now into the hour 38 of the live blog.
How long until it's longer than Jason Alexander and Britney Spears' marriage? Another 4 hours?
No, she's got to hit 55 hours to beat Britney Spears' marriage, which I wouldn't entirely rule out. So basically, the big move so far is that Michael Duggar, the Shadow Culture Secretary, has been sacked. Maria Eagle has been moved from Shadow Defence to Shadow Culture, and Emily Thornberry has been moved to Shadow Defence. That is the really significant move, because she believes in the unilateral abandonment of Britain's nuclear deterrent. It is the first time since 1988 that a unilateralist has held that post under Labour. Because the thing is, although a lot of the young people who were inspired by Corbyn and a lot of the sympathetic commentators in the media and in the media were very anti-Blair, for the key people around Corbyn, both the influential people in the grassroots and in his office, it's actually Neil Kinnock who begins Labour's fall from grace. So for them, it's about peeling back what Diane described to me as the totemic abandonment of nuclear disarmament. And so that puts him in a strong position to do that.
But that's a kind of interesting reflection of, I mean, there's been this big argument with Michael Crick saying, you know, don't say moderates anymore, and trying to find out what the various factions are called. I know it's a pet peeve of yours when people who are Brownites get referred to as Blairites. Like, Blairite is this dismissive word for centre-right. But there is this interesting split on the Labour left, which is that the trade unions are largely pro-Trident, right? Because the Trident means jobs, defence industry means jobs. So there's a split between the kind of radical left and the institutional left on the Labour left.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, the difficulty with labels, and the reason why I get irritated with the use of the word Blairite is particularly in this reshuffle, it shows why, if you use it, you haven't understood what's going on. Because Pat McFadden was also sacked. Why was Hilary Benn not at risk? Because basically his mates, who are mostly on the soft left or a Brownite, would have resigned. There are no Blairites left, which means that actually if you fire a Blairite, there are going to be very few resignations. The only reason why there have been resignations post-Pat McFadden, in a display of astonishing incompetence, some idiot, the Team Corbyn decided to brief that one of the reasons why he'd been sacked is his answer in the Paris attacks, which I have here.
So it's something about the idea of whether or not you can blame, you know, entirely the terrorists, or whether or not their actions are in some ways influenced by Western foreign policy, which is quite a kind of interesting discussion to have, right? And I think that everybody would accept that our actions in the Middle East have contributed to destabilization, have engendered a huge amount of resentment. But ultimately, it is no one's, you know, millions of people in the Middle East have reacted to that not by going into Paris cafes and starting to shoot people.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, my sort of personal take on the whole blowback question is I think actually, Pat McFadden once said, and he thought that it was the last vestige of imperialism on the British left, because, you know, just to assume that, you know, actually people are capable of making the best of a bad job. You know, if you look at Palestine, where people are having an utterly terrible time, the overwhelming majority of Palestinians don't blow things up. If you look at, South Africa under apartheid, you know, my grandparents didn't put tires around people's necks and set them on fire. Most people do not react to awful situations with violence. The ones who do are thugs, and it's just insulting to the people who don't.
But that's what's fascinating, is that I mean, that question was disloyal, yeah, right? So let's not beat around the bush. That question was designed to draw a contrast with Jeremy Corbyn. He wants to explain a lot more, right? He wants to try and understand, and to the extent that shoot to kill, he kind of went, well, what about the rule of law? So asking Cameron that question was a kind of attempt to deliberately embarrass Jeremy Corbyn. So I can see, when I stretch to see from Jeremy Corbyn's point of view, that is not a helpful thing for one of your ministers to be doing, is it?
Yeah, and I mean, on the live blog, when Pat McFadden went, I did say, you know, actually it is perfectly reasonable to reconfigure your front bench so it is closer to your opinion. It's just there were other things Pat McFadden had done. So the weird thing is they were asked this and they said, oh yeah, that's part of the reason, and then listed some other reasons. Just like, if you had other reasons, here's an idea. Don't use the one which is going to compel other people to resign, because there now have been, including, from Johnny Reynolds, who actually on the railways is at one with Jeremy Corbyn. Corbyn actually thanked him and said, yeah, we share an interest in, it just means that the reshuffle is still ongoing. And it just,
it really draws attention to one of the things that turns a good number of voters off about Jeremy Corbyn, right? It's kind of saying, you might as well say, we've sacked him because he said that our economic plans were stupid and we were planning to, you know, cede sovereignty to Russia. Don't say something that is a bad thing that is obviously connecting and is a Tory attack line, because it kind of hands them that gift, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, is the Conservatives want to go into the next election on a platform of security. Jeremy Corbyn can't keep you safe. Jeremy Corbyn has said he wants to abolish the army. Jeremy Corbyn wants to get rid of Trident. Jeremy Corbyn is sympathetic to terrorists. So it is, from a tactical perspective, in terms of winning the next election, it is a howler.
I'm just going to say a brief positive word for Emily Thornberry, who is actually my constituency MP, because I am a member of the London elite that is taking over the Labour Party, clearly. But I think that's not a bad shout, is it? I mean, she's very clever, she's very quick, she's good, she can do TV, she can master a brief really quickly. I know there are some questions about this law firm that prosecutes soldiers, and I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find anybody who's a unilateral disarmer in the party who you couldn't find some complaint like that about. But it's not in... Once all the kind of resentments died down, actually these are not bad appointments, are they?
No, I think Emily Thornberry is a very good appointment. I don't really understand why she was looked over last time. I agree. I also think she was very shabbily treated by Ed Miliband.
Over Rochester,
because actually she she doesn't really tweet so much anymore, but she used to tweet photos of things which to my mind seemed fairly banal all the time.
Although didn't she just tweet image from Las Malvinas? And that's upset the Falklanders. Or someone's dug up a time when she's previously tweeted it. So I think if I was Emily Thornberry now, I'd probably just start tweeting a lot of, you know, kind of image from Michael Duggar's back garden.
But she is very good, and she can go on television and get a message out. And one of the problems that the Corbyn project has is because they have a missing generation. The 2010 parliamentary battles did not go well for the left. A lot of the 2015ers, some of whom will never be ready, and some of them will need to grow into it. And so really, Diane Abbott, other than Emily Thornberry, is the only other minister who is both sort of a pucker Corbynite and knows her way around the TV studio. So it's a very good appointment from that. And the thing is whenever there's a reshuffle, and the interesting thing is it already moved on a bit with this. When Michael Duggar was sacked, people were like, oh, you know, how could this happen? How could this guy who was talking bad about Jeremy all over town have been sacked? It's good. When the dust settles at the moment, obviously it's hour 38, I don't want to speculate what it will look like for hour 55, Corbyn will be in a stronger position than he was at the start of the reshuffle.
Well, that's the thing that struck me, is very much about how, it's going to upset the PLP, and the PLP are going to feel a certain amount of resentment, but ultimately it's like that nothing matters until they're so resentful that they try and launch a coup attempt, right? That's the thing. Any amount of resentment it just doesn't have anywhere to go.
I also think nothing really matters until the members have changed their view about Corbyn. So the one risk, I think, I mean, I don't subscribe to the view that the average Labour activist has gone mad, or that the new joiners are all people who don't care about winning elections. I know that's what the YouGov poll says, but I think it's a bit like, it looks like that in 2020 we'll have a contest between George Osborne, who everyone hates, and Jeremy Corbyn, who everyone hates. Sorry, I know many of our listeners like him, but you are in an extreme minority. You are outnumbered by the morbidly obese in this country. it is strange to like Jeremy Corbyn. And I say that as someone who voted for AV in 2011. What will happen is you'll see polls and people will be asked, do you care about whether or not you like the Prime Minister? And people will go, no. Because they'll either be choosing between Jeremy Corbyn, who they think is a risk to national security, but his heart is in the right place, or Osborne, who they think will keep them safe, but they think is a bastard. But if there was a nice option, if there was someone who they thought would keep them in the, who their heart was in the right place, who'd keep them safe, they'd go, of course I care that my Prime Minister's a nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when members say, I don't care about winning the next election, what they really mean is, I don't think Jeremy Corbyn can win the next election. I don't think Yvette Cooper can win the next election. I don't think Andy Burnham can win the next election. I don't think Liz Kendall can win the next election. And so if I'm going to lose, I might as well lose in my comfort zone. I don't think members... So I think, then basically Jeremy is strong up until the point someone who emerges who could win an election. At that point, I think he would be at risk. But I don't see anyone in the parliamentary party who has a better chance of winning the 2020 election than Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, let's just turn briefly to the Tories, because there's been a strange kind of dualism this week where the Tories have had is a sort of reverse of the same problem, right? Which is a Europe, which is a perennial kind of open sore. David Cameron has announced that he will suspend ministerial responsibility for the duration of referendum campaigning. And the kind of quid pro quo for that is that they have to shut up until then. Some people, including, I think, Janan Ganesh in the FT, have said they think that this Tory-Europe split is overdone, and actually the party will kind of keep its, it will twang back into place like a piece of elastic. Do you think that's true? Do you think Tory splits is a theme that we should store up for the end of the year in the same way that Labour splits will be a running theme?
No, I don't think it is the same, partly because... The reason why Tory splits over Europe were a recurring theme of the Thatcher government. The reason why they became debilitating under Major and Haig and Ian Duncan Smith to a lesser extent is because the Conservative Party didn't feel it could win. And in 1992 to 1997, Tony Blair didn't terrify them. They didn't have this thing of, but if we mess it up, then this Bolshevik.
Yeah.
Will take over. And the thing that a lot of Labour activists, I think, misunderstand is when the Tories honk on about Jeremy Corbyn being a threat to national security, they believe it. They do not want their splits to be the thing which hands power to a Corbyn-led Labour Party. I think, however, it feels likely to me that the sweet spot to be, if you want to be Cameron's successor, is probably to be the person who backs Leave and for Leave to have lost in the referendum.
In the kind of SNP post-referendum kind of, you then have had the right opinion and it's just sad for you that you didn't get what you want. So that means Boris Johnson or Theresa May, presumably. I mean, that's the thing I find fascinating, is that the economy, George Osborne got away with it once, saying, all those things I promised, well, we couldn't now do them, so you've got to give me another 5 years and this, I'll definitely do them. already looks like he won't be able to do them. But there could be a really serious shock to the world economy, or which would have repercussions for the British economy. I mean, it's fascinating to see the SNP, you know, predicated talking about oil at $135 a barrel, and we're looking at, you know, it's far below that. You know, George Osborne's sums could prove pretty spectacularly bad. The question is then whether or not still people think that Labour are unelectable. I mean, can the Tories make themselves unelectable? I think is a really interesting question for the next. You know, I think the next election could well be a choice between two options that the country, neither of which they find.
Yeah, and then the fascinating thing is it will test a lot of theories about how median voter behaviour works. Because some people will think, you know, so there's one argument that if you have two options who no one likes, it drives turnout up. Because people who fear Corbyn will go to the ballot papers and people who hate Osborne will go to the ballot papers. The other risk is, of course, that turnout will drop. The interesting thing is usually there's a strong third party, but no one likes the Liberal Democrats. So it is fascinating because both Osborne and Corbyn, if you looked at their numbers in a vacuum, you'd go, wow, they're going to get crushed at the next election. If you look at them together, you'd still expect Corbyn to get crushed, to be honest. But it's less certain if it's Osborne than it is if it is any of the other options.
I thought that polling about, I mean, it's a very small subsample and blah, 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 about the Midlands and about the fact that Boris would do much better. I feel like on behalf of my people, I should apologise, really, that we're obviously quite well won over by someone who's quite good at being on Have I Got News For You. But I think that was a really interesting poll. But no doubt we'll return to this next week when it might very well still be the reshuffle.
Oh, God.
But that's all for now.
Hi, I'm Caroline.
And I'm Anna.
And we host the New Statesman's pop culture podcast, Seriously.
This week, we talked about horror parody show Scream Queens, the film of the Alan Bennett play Lady in the Van, and 90s children's dog-themed TV show Wishbone.
You can find us at newstatesman.com/SRSLY or on iTunes or on the podcatcher of your choice.
Hello, Helen and I are joined by Stephanie Boland, our digital assistant, to discuss a recent essay by Siri Hudspeth on how men and women writers are perceived differently. Hudspeth discusses the different way that her work is reacted to and contrasts it with, among other people, the work of, and I'm now going to fail to pronounce it, Nausgaard?
We decided it's Karl Ove Nausgaard.
I've heard Knausgaard.
Okay, let's go overboard on the kind of Norwegian thing, because that'll sound cooler.
You will hear a variety of pronunciations of Nausgaard in this podcast.
So I think probably we need to start by setting the scene, because miraculously there are people whose lives are yet untouched by the godlike genius of Karl Ove Nausgaard. So he's been writing, it's going to end up being six parts, right, Stephanie? The sequence of novels called My Struggle. And that is deliberately an echo of Mein Kampf.
It is a deliberate reference to Mein Kampf. It's called Min Kampf in Norwegian.
So this kind of gets mentioned every single time. Why? Like, what's the shtick of that?
I don't know. I genuinely don't know.
Because it's sort of just like putting a big sign on the front cover going, edgy, isn't it?
Controversy. Yeah, and I don't know if there's something about personal struggle, and actually is personal struggle as bad as...
Yeah,
anyway. I kind of don't want to go into that.
In these novels, he chronicles his life in kind of punishing detail.
Yes. So they're really deeply confessional. I think he tries to get as close to memory as possible, although some of his dialogue suggests to me that his memory is not incredible. And they begin by charting his years as a young man, and then he goes back to his childhood and his relationship with his father. And they were fairly radical novels to be published in Norway. Well, I gather that kind of confessional writing, especially men writing about masculinity in very self-probing terms, isn't really the done thing, but they've been hugely popular.
So it's something like, Norway's a country of 5 million people, this is the statistic.
It's a tiny country.
And they've sold 450,000 novels in the original Norwegian, presumably published, bought largely by Norwegians.
Yeah, and I read somebody the other day saying in Norway this is the equivalent of kind of going into the town square and taking all your clothes off. I don't know how accurate that is, but it's really so quite radical there.
In some ways, would it be slightly unfair of me, and I say to someone who hasn't read them in either English or Norwegian, to characterise them? Is it a bit like, almost like Angela's Ashes or something, but without the tradition of a history of Ms. Mem or whatever to kind of make it seem so run-of-the-mill?
But he hasn't had a difficult childhood. That's the thing. I mean, Angela's Ashes, that whole strain that kind of came up with that and... The one about that they turned into sleepers, you know, the one they turned into the film with Brad Pitt about people having a terrible, miserable time in their boarding school.
It's not that dark. I mean, it's kind of my father beat me and things like that, but nothing to my mind where I kind of go, oh, you have suffered an exceptional childhood.
It's auto-fiction, right? So it's kind of, it's a bit like the Zuckerman novels by Roth.
Well, this is what Siri Husvedt says, is she introduces the question of auto-fiction, which Knausgård says he's not heard of, but this is a tradition of fiction where it's between the line of autobiography and auto-fiction, and fiction. So I Love Dick is probably the best.
So that's Chris Krause's...
This is Chris Krause's...
And which is a female Chris. I think it's probably quite important to say at this stage.
Yeah.
The thing I find is, again, I haven't read them, and I am kind of wanting to interrogate my own biases about why I haven't read them. And I think it's the blokiness that puts me off, because actually I've read a huge amount of confessional fiction. There was a great piece on, I think, Salon at the end of last year called about the first person industrial complex. And, you know, internet writing is so reliant on this kind of... One of the ones that's mentioned in that piece is a piece, I think, that Jezebel published,
or XO Jane,
which is another site for girls. And this was about somebody who claimed they slept with their father. And, you know, like, there's a Jezebel piece about, you know, what it's like to do your first poo after having given birth. You know, really incredibly either, you know, personal or embarrassing kind of stuff. And this writing, that kind of scrutiny is so associated in online writing with women that that's why I kind of... Maybe I should read them in order to see whether or not this is true. I do worry that there is a feeling that you praise it when it's done by a man and you think it's incredibly narcissistic without any redeeming artistic qualities when it's done by a woman.
I think that's completely true. I mean, I know Catherine Angel wrote a brilliant piece in the Los Angeles Review of Books last year about gender in publishing, where she talked about this idea that we're more willing to read genius into a male writer. And in the case of Knausgård, I mean, it reminds me a lot of these sort of daddy bloggers, where the whole point of your column is that you're a dad at home with kids, which obviously a female journalist isn't able to build a whole column around this idea. That, you know, masculinity, you set out to explore something about being a dad or doing masculinity and you end up fetishizing it. And I feel that may be the case with my struggle.
Yeah, it's interesting that Gabby Hinsliff basically had to write a blog about being a mum looking after her kids at home. And then she was able to use that to leverage her way back into writing about the bubble. But she wasn't allowed to kind of turn her regular column into a mum slot. Because even The Guardian, the only sort of regular mum they have is a single mum, where it's clearly partly about The Guardian saying to itself, oh look, we've got a
But they do have a dad. They have a dad.
Tim Dowling.
Thinking of Stuart Heritage, who writes more of the kind of classic kind of... So Tim Dowling's kids are older, right, I think, slightly, whereas Stuart Heritage's children are younger. And there was one that was, I think, like the daddy blog, which was, you know, my wife normally stays at home with the kids. One day I actually have to look after them. You know, by 6 p.m. the walls are covered in tomato sauce. I'm, you know, I've gone feral in the kitchen in my pants. And, you know, thank God she's here. I don't know how she does it every day. And it's kind of not deemed to be as interesting to read, well, here's how I do it every day. It's actually just really boring, really hard work.
It's strange because there's also a double standard than Husvedt talks about in the essay of people assuming that her husband has taught her the stuff about is it neuroscience?
Psychoanalysis and neurology.
But I got this actually when it was really interesting. When I published that piece about motherhood and politics last summer, I had a lot of people going, well, why aren't you talking about parenthood, actually? And I said, well, because actually what's happening here is people physically have to take time off work for maternity leave, and then the biological process is involved for that. So actually set that aside from the fact that women are far more likely to be the primary caregiver of children. But that wasn't deemed interesting. But then I saw that Gabby Hinsliff ironically published a piece about dads, like, this is a thing about dads. And no one said to her, oh, what about mums? And I think it is that kind of news agenda thing about only the exceptional is interesting.
Which is ludicrous as well, because obviously the social cost of having a child is always going to be so much greater for women. There have been so many studies that go, you take a career hit, just, you know, a hiring committee will look on you with slight suspicion if they think you're going to have a baby in the next 5 years, and you don't do that with a married man.
But that's dog bites man, whereas I think the idea of a man doing the same thing, and I think that comes back to NASCAR, is that it is man bites dog. And that's what's interesting, is that, oh, we're seeing this a man doing what is traditionally seen as a very female type of writing.
Well, it's also, I think, if a woman does confessional writing, like you say, I know Catherine Angel makes a comparison with Rachel Cusk, whose outline was on the Bailey's shortlist last year. And, you know, if you've ever got a boring half an hour at work, go read the Guardian comments below the line on a Rachel Cusk review, because it's obscene, you know, narcissist, and how she probably sits in Waterstones looking at her own book covers and things like this.
The question I sort of want to throw open is, I guess, you know, the reason why I haven't read NASCAR is when I used to work in a bookshop, I had the people who bought it were the kind of customers I didn't much like. Would it be better if we took things like NASCAR less seriously when a man did it, or if we took it as seriously when a woman did it? You know, just in terms of how you see it as a bit of literary endeavour.
I think the thing is, I think we need to get over the hang-up about confessional writing being narcissistic. A lot of the best writing that has ever been has been incredibly self-involved. Mm. And that as an attack is one of the weakest attacks you can make on a writer, because, you know, writing is about trying to understand
writing
people.
Writing is a self-involved industry.
And people are generally pretty much alike. So if you can understand yourself, you've gone a long way to understanding other people. It's like the attack on writers for being attention seekers. Well, whoever writes a novel, so in the you know, desperate hope that no one will read it.
Yeah, I think I think Knausgaard's kind of a particular case, because I know his last book in the UK sold 2,000 copies or something obscenely low. So that in that case, I kind of question the literary culture's industry around him. I think generally I'm always for elevating women rather than denigrating men. But if we have to do six of one, half a dozen of the other, that's fine by me.
And I think also we should acknowledge, and this is probably something that we need to talk about more, the large role that, you know, buying a novel, reading a novel is a kind of cultural signalling process. Mm. I mean, the funny thing is to look at pictures. I was just looking at some pictures of NASCAR, and he's got, you know, this great mane of sort of salt and peppery blonde hair. He's, you know, big, dominating Norwegian. He looks like he could go out with an axe and chop some wood, and that's a big part of it. If he was a kind of tubby little bold fella, this wouldn't be an epic struggle. There is a big problem about the fact that we assume that only kind of beautiful, interesting people have, you know, big, interesting lives. I think that's another thing.
Or that you have to be a certain degree of attractive to write from a neutral position. Because if you're not gorgeous, obviously, you know, your bitterness and vulnerability and problem with your masculinity probably isn't universal, right?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point about masculine vulnerability, because I think although people feel that he's doing kind of quite an unmanly thing, and that's something that Siri Husvedt comes back to, at the end of the day, you still don't look at him and think of a weakling and a loser. And I think if his physicality gave that message off more strongly, that would be more of a problem.
There'd be a very different reception there.
Well, we sold it. We sold gender in publishing. Everyone should look like a giant, strapping, 6-foot Norwegian. That's basically...
I'm going to go and get working on that.
Job done. I'm going to get my plaid shirt out. I'm going to wrestle a bear.
I already look like a strapping 6-foot Norwegian.
There we go. Wrestle bears in the office, that is true. Great. Sorted. Thank you.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's time for Stephen's Anecdote of the Week.
So during the live blog that is at time of recording still going, an entertaining story reached me of two Labour staffers who shall remain nameless, who actually hooked up during the, while waiting to find out what was happening with the longest reshuffle. So I really hope they get married, because I think that would just be the world's loveliest story, and also a great premise for a movie.
Also, they could call their baby something like...
Maria.
I was going to say like reshufflier, but I think that might have been... What's a baby's name that has... Well, and maybe that can be our call to action for this week. Listeners, if you can think of a great name for the baby that might possibly come from the staffers who hooked up during the reshuffle, why not tweet either me or Stephen?
And now we're going to call George in Westminster to find out what's going on over there.
Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George. So what's been going on this week? How are people feeling?
So it's been the reshuffle that's dominated everything. You actually had quite a significant announcement from David Cameron, of course, saying that cabinet ministers would be given a free vote on EU membership. But that was entirely overshadowed by the reshuffle, to Labour's loss, actually, because were Labour in a stronger position, they would have been able to lambast David Cameron as weak. But it is the reshuffle that's dominated everything, and it officially ended about an hour ago, after nearly 66 hours.
Wow, blimey! So it did get longer than Britney's marriage in the end. Why did it go on so long? Do we have any idea why that was?
So I think it was partly because there were a lot of complicated conversations which clearly needed to be had, particularly with Hilary Benn, and the exact understanding they've come to is still a matter of dispute. Also because Jeremy has limited experience of reshuffles, to put it mildly. Clearly, he'd never been involved with one until he actually became the top man. And then because on Tuesday there were four ministerial statements, which meant that they did have problems, obviously, getting hold of people when they needed to, because they were in the chamber. And that was why the main news was announced at nearly 1 a.m. On Wednesday morning. But I think the big picture is that Jeremy Corbyn's internal position has been strengthened by this reshuffle. Hilary Benn has been kept in post, to the disappointment of some of his allies, but he's got a trident opponent at defence, Emily Thornberry replacing Marie Eagle, who was an unambiguous supporter of the nuclear deterrent. And that means that although I'm told by senior sources that a free vote is still likely when the House of Commons votes on Trident renewal later this year, the defence review that Labour's holding is now led by two opponents of Trident, Emily Thornberry and Ken Livingstone. And there's now clearly a pathway to Labour becoming a unilateralist party again, to adopting a policy of scrapping Trident were it to come to power in 2020.
And what's the kind of mood in Westminster and the PLP about the reshuffle? Are Team Corbyn feeling as if they've had a big win?
I think they feel that defence is their big win. They've also been able to demonstrate through the sackings of Michael Duggar, who was the Shadow Culture Secretary, and Pat McFadden, who was the Shadow Europe Minister, that there are consequences for, as they put it, disloyalty. And that's a signal to other Shadow Cabinet members that if they overstep the mark in the view of Team Corbyn, then they will be sacked. And also, we've learned now that it's possible to sack people and not to face significant reprisals. So although you had 9 Shadow Cabinet members who came out after Michael Duggar's sacking and lamented his loss and praised him, none of them came close to resigning. And so I think Corbyn's authority has been strengthened by that. I think the view of his opponents is that they've managed to keep Hilary Benn, which they're pleased about. They've managed to keep Rosie Winterton as chief whip, which they see as a big victory. But they concede that they may have picked the wrong battle in going to the wall to protect Hilary Benn by threatening mass resignations. Because, of course, that dispute over Syria is in the past. There may be future disputes over foreign intervention, but the big battle to come, which everyone is now focused on, is of course Trident. And some of them do feel that their efforts should have been focused on keeping Marie Eagle or a Trident supporter in that role.
Trident is, of course, totemic in the Labour Party, which is why it's so divisive. Europe is totemic within the Conservative Party, and Cameron has also been forced to move to manage his split. Would you tell us a bit about the background to that?
Yes, so David Cameron said as recently in January in an interview with Andrew Marr that he wasn't going to offer a free vote as Howard Wilson did, of course, in 1975, the last time we had an EU referendum. But he's been forced to climb down, and everyone always thought it was a question of when rather than if, because it is politically the only sensible option when you've got as many as 6 or 7 cabinet ministers who oppose EU membership. It's the best means of trying to hold the Conservative Party together and avoid a formal split or sort of permanent permanent schism. And the risk of it, of course, is that it likely increases the number of cabinet ministers who will be prepared to support, who will be prepared to oppose EU membership, because they won't have to resign in order to do so. The danger of that is that increases the likelihood of a no vote of Brexit. And of course, although he's not saying this publicly when asked, the likelihood is that David Cameron would have to resign if the UK voted to leave the EU. But it seemed the inevitable option, and it is by far the least worst one.
Ah, right. Thank you very much for that. We'll let you go on with the day. And that's bye to George and bye from me.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.